Good morning. I'm awake. Barely. But it's an honor to be here and to speak to such a distinguished group of people. I have to get mic'd, but I think that's happened now. So, with no further comment, we will begin. First, some initial observations are in order before we specifically address the important topic of sex differences and their complementary nature. First, there are only three different ways to treat sex differences. First, one can assume that there are no sex differences that are important and that impinge on personality and behavior in a significant way. But this assumption, very common in elite society today, flies in the face of a large and growing amount of contrary evidence, and thus constitutes a denial of important truth and information. It also flies in the face of enormous amounts of historical and cultural evidence that shows that male and female differences have been important markers signifying different roles in virtually every known society and culture. Some of these worldwide social differences between men and women are identified by the evolutionary psychologist Ann Campbell, who, quote, notes that among the human universals found in every known society are binary distinctions between men and women, division of labor by sex, more child care by women, more aggression by men, and domination of the public square by men. End quote. Second, one can assume not only that important sex differences exist, but also that these differences mean that one sex is superior to the other. The common historical example is what is often called macho theory, where men dominate and are considered superior to women. In principle, there could also be a femo theory that reversed the macho understanding. This seems to be historically uncommon, and as a social organization, probably non-existent, but it is proposed and developed by many of today's feminists. The macho theory, however, has been strongly critiqued by feminists and others as unjust and neglectful of women's obvious strengths and virtues. Many of these criticisms are quite valid. The third alternative has been termed the complementary model, and that is the model I will develop here. The complementary model accepts that men and women are often different in important respects and thus addresses the truth of such evidence. However, it also assumes that men and women are equal in dignity and moral importance. This position follows from a Judeo-Christian theological perspective. God created both men and women in his image, and thus it is when they are taken together that they represent a more complete image of their Creator. This model could be accepted on other than biblical grounds, but certainly it gets basic support from the book of Genesis and from much recent theological and even some secular writing. Here, we're all familiar, I believe, here with the writings of John Paul II and many others. Now, in addition to the property of complementarity, in addition to that notion, I will propose here that many of the weaknesses of each sex are matched by the complementary strength of the other. This complementarity also implies that men and women create a synergistic interaction that has a special fruitfulness. Most commonly, of course, the creation of a child and then in time, the creation of a family and intergenerational families. Sister Mary Prudence Allen is especially known for this emphasis on synergy within the framework of complementarity. She also summarizes the four basic principles of the complementary model, which she describes as follows, quote, "The four principles of complementarity are equal dignity, significant difference, synergetic relation, and intergenerational fruition." That's from Sister Mary Prudence. An important point now, before we proceed. The proposed differences between men and women are based on averages, and there are always a good number of exceptions. For example, men on average are taller than women, but some women are taller than many men. So keep in mind, when thinking about differences between the sexes, these are usually almost always based on averages, and there's always overlap and some exceptions. Now, I'm also quite aware that the notion of important sex differences is controversial. Many postmodern and feminist intellectuals claim that a person's gender is a social construct and has no serious basis in our biological nature. This approach, let me explain. This is again coming from Sister Mary Prudence. The approach here, in contrast, the approach I will be taking, can be called, and this is a term I take from Sister Prudence Allen, gender reality. This contrasts with the notion of the more modern feminist position, which will be called gender ideology. So that's the struggle that in many ways is being addressed when I talk about complementary differences. Gender reality versus gender ideology. The fact that there are important sex differences has become much more accepted and better understood in the last few decades, thanks to a large number of scientifically based book treatments of the topic. Some of the examples include books by Baron Cohen, Brizendine, another one by Brizendine, Budashevsky, Buss, Christian and Davidson, Geary, Gurian, Rhodes, Tannen, Moore and Jessel, and many others. Those are book-like length treatments of important sexual differences. This evidence, however, has not had much impact on the general culture, especially that of the liberal elites and the university world. But it's out there as a large body of documented scientific evidence where the authors of the studies and the summaries are both men and women. So keep that in mind. It's sitting there, in my judgment, as an alternative understanding that can resolve the contemporary denial of reality by the gender ideology people and the hostility created by the other kind of model of which one sex dominates the other. This is the way to move forward. Now, we begin with simple physical differences. As I noted earlier, men are on average considerably taller, bigger, and physically stronger than women. Men's physical strength is usually accepted and appreciated by women. As a rule, women prefer and usually marry men who are taller, bigger, and stronger, and also usually older than themselves. It was always interesting to me to see these radical feminists when they were often pairing up a little bit with certain men. The men were always taller, older, and usually pretty rich and successful. Men and women don't pair off randomly with respect to each other's height and weight and age. Sometimes a woman will marry a shorter man. but he is often powerful, rich, and a successful man, who in these ways makes up for its shorter height. It appears that women want to feel protected from outside threats, and such male characteristics imply they will be. Women also typically, but not always, prefer men whose status and power or wealth suggests they will be able to provide resources. If they feel secure, they then can concentrate on their major concern of actively maintaining a social network of friends, having children, and raising a family, and so forth. Good evidence for the sexually different long-term mating strategies of men and women can be found in the work of David Buss. Not all of his particular claims and interpretations need to be accepted, but his central position that men and women have many biologically based behaviors, his framework is evolutionary theory, that position is generally accepted. Buss, however, does not address the issue of complementarity, but many of his findings can be viewed in that way. Before we get to some interesting specific dimensions about differences, a few more general observations will be useful. As a rule, women are more involved in personal relationships. This is hardly news. Women seek companionship and intimacy. Their lovers, their children, their friends are central to their sense of well-being. For men, this is less so, and instead their status and their accomplishments are much more central to their sense of well-being. Many other differences flow from these two basic ones, namely that men mostly seek achievement in the outside world and women mostly seek positive interpersonal relationships. For example, women's well-documented higher verbal abilities, memory for faces, and memory for interpersonal events, as compared to men's greater risk-taking, aggression, abstract abilities, are interpretable in this way. After all, when we think about it, children need an attentive interpersonal parent who is readily available and sensitive to their needs. That is, a woman or a mother. But they also need protection and they need resources that must be aggressively sought in the outside world, as commonly provided by a man, a father. We will begin now looking at more particular differences by looking at boys and girls, since it's in childhood and in actually even earlier than that, in the very first months of the baby's life, that these differences begin to show. From the beginning, girls are much more interpersonally oriented than boys. They smile and talk earlier and are much more responsive to people in general. Boys are relatively more interested in things, especially things that move and make noise. These differences are now clearly linked to hormone differences in estrogen and testosterone, and they show up at an early age. The frequently observed involvement of little girls with dolls and their response to new babies is just one small support for this difference. I'm now going to summarize just briefly some of the findings about the differences between boys and girls from a particular book by Gurian. The title of the book is Boys and Girls Learn Differently, so that even in grammar school, the differences between how they learn is something that's relevant. Boys develop testosterone. Girls develop estrogen. Testosterone sets the male brain, and it makes it immune to female hormones. Estrogen sets the female brain and makes it immune, more or less, to male hormones. The male fetus is generally more active than the girl fetus. Cortex in the boys develops more slowly. Cortex in the girls develops more quickly. 6 weeks in utero, the sexual identity begins to develop, 6 weeks, and the brain changes. Normal template of the human brain appears to be female. At 6 weeks, a large dose of testosterone changes the brain permanently for boys. Lack of testosterone allows the structure to stay the same in girls and to become essentially fixed. The brain in male fetus is more lateralized. And this is a very important point I'll get to later. You know, you have two halves to your brain, and the two halves often function rather differently. We'll get to that later. But boys tend to be more lateralized. Either they're focused in one half of the brain more, or in the other. And girls are less lateralized. That means they're less specialized in one half of the brain. We'll develop that as time goes on. The male brain structures already in very early ages are less flexible. The girl's brain structure is more flexible. The boy's brain is less internalized, less focused on internal structures of the brain like emotions, the amygdala, that whole area. The girl's brain is less externalized, focused on, say, visual perception, less focused on that. Boys, when the brain is idling, that's the notion that was sort of like the resting state when it doesn't seem to be attending to anything. In the boys, the idling of the brain when it is usually in the brainstem, sometimes called the reptilian brain. Girls, when the brain is idling, is more often in the limbic system, in the emotional brain. So this has to do even with how girls are already idling more in the emotional part of the brain. And boys are sitting there more or less like reptiles. Anyway, they have zoned out in a sense in which, what are you thinking? Thinking? Okay? All right. Boys' brain, the brain mass of boys is about 10% larger than that of girls. Boys have a smaller corpus callosum, and girls have a larger corpus callosum. Now, what is the corpus callosum? A very important structure. It's the structure that connects the two halves of the brain. It's like a flat cable that of neurons that allows you to move from left to right hemisphere quickly. Remember I said that girls are less lateralized. Well, one of the reasons they're less lateralized is they have a larger connecting set of neurons going through the corpus callosum. Their corpus callosum is larger than in boys, and it's denser. That is, has more neurons. And so they can move back and forth between the two hemispheres very more quickly. Boys very quickly prefer mechanical or sometimes structural toys. Girls prefer soft, cuddly toys or interpersonal toys, where they talk to each other and have relationships. I once gave two blocks to one of my granddaughters, and she didn't like my, she took the two blocks and they started talking to each other. They were two people. I gave them to my grandson. He got down on the floor and started to build a wall. Boys look at objects for shorter but more active periods. The boy gazes at the mother half as long as the girl does. Girls' play is more cheerful than boys' play. Motor activity for boys is more vigorous than in girls. Boys speak first words later than girls. Girls develop better and earlier vocabulary. Boys are less able to multitask, and girls are better able to multitask. Now, that multitasking is, I think, related to that corpus callosum allowing you to move back and forth. Boys are already demonstrated at better at general math and at 3D visualizing and reasoning about 3Ds. Girls will read earlier and better. Boys seem to be already more able to separate emotion from reason. Boys are more likely to ignore voices, even their parents. Girls are less likely to ignore voices, and especially less likely to ignore familiar voices. Here are some more examples. Boys tend to like abstract reasoning. They tend to be moderately more deductive in conceptualizing things from general principles. Girls tend to be moderately more inductive. Girls tend to use words when they learn. Boys often learn silently. Girls tend to prefer things as described in everyday language. Boys already seem to find jargon and coded language more interesting. Girls tend to be better listeners, hear more of what is said, and are more receptive to detail. Boys hear less of what's being said and often ask, therefore, for evidence. Boys get bored more easily than girls and require more varying stimulants to keep them attentive. Girls are better at self-managing boredom. Boys tend to use more space than girls when they learn, especially when they're younger. Movement seems to help boys stimulate their brains, but also manage and relieve impulsive behaviors that boys have. Boys are much more likely to use physical force to settle differences. They'll fight more to settle a difference as compared to girls. Cooperative learning is easier for girls to master. Boys tend to focus on performing the task well without as much sensitivity to the emotions of others around them. Also, girls show more empathy than boys. This is a fairly reliable finding at different ages, that girls are more empathic. Boys form pecking orders, which are more important to them than the social strata are even to girls. Research has shown that a girl who finds herself low in the pecking order of the girls' society is less likely to fail in school than boys in the same situation. Males at the top of the pecking order secrete less cortisol, and cortisol is a stress hormone. And when the boys are at the bottom of the pecking order, they're secreting a lot of cortisol. And that cortisol is a stress hormone, and it gets in the way of learning and other performances and leads to boys who are being pushed out of the central hierarchy to be more apt to fail in school. Boys tend toward symbolic texts, diagrams, and graphs. Pictures which stimulate the right hemisphere are often relied on in male learning. Okay, we'll now go from boys and girls to teenagers, okay, high school. Boys in high school are going to be much more often involved in criminal behavior than girls. And this is a common observation. Boys, however, are less likely than girls to suffer clinical depression. For example, in adolescence, girls are more likely to be depressed. Boys with an extra female chromosome do less well at spatial reasoning than other boys. Girls with higher than normal testosterone are better at spatial reasoning than other girls. Boys' social acceptance in high school is based very much on physical strength and athleticism. Girls' social acceptance is based on peer relationships and beauty. Gurian concludes that pursuit of power is a universal male trait, while pursuit of a comfortable environment is a universal female trait. Males are 85% of students in advanced placement computer science classes. Females outperform males in verbal and communication skills. Okay, so much for boys and girls and teenagers. We'll now turn to adult men and adult women. The recent evidence for this is not at all in contradiction to what I've already mentioned for boys and girls, but for example, of course, Cosolino presents considerable evidence that a mother's attachment to her child is often a kind of addiction, since biochemicals and brain structures similar to those in drug addiction are involved. The mother can be almost addicted to her baby. Awfully, a very good thing, in fact, anyway. Thus, research with primates suggests that the activation of the opioid system of mother and child propels and regulates the attachment process. When female primates come together for contact, grooming, or play, endorphin levels increase in both parent and child. Human mothers often report feeling distress, anxiety, and sadness when they are separated from their newborns. In large part, this response is caused by the precipitous decline in endorphin levels that are triggered by separation. There's more to a mother's rewards than those things that come from her response to her internal hormones, but it seems that much of the reward does hinge on her body, specifically on endogenous opioid hormones. So, I mean, when I saw our children when they were being born and I saw my wife's devotion to them and the time she spent with them, and how, you know, babies are time-consuming, and they, you know, what reward do they give? They don't give you money. They take it or cost it. They don't give you food. You give them food. You know, where's the reward? I was just amazed. I was naive about this, and I was amazed to watch the time and energy and devotion of my wife to our children, this showing of love. Well, in fact, it looks like a lot of this is built in. And, of course, it would have to be rewarding. Most women would say, oh, the baby's so rewarding just to be looking at and touching and holding and hugging and, you know, of course, it makes me feel good and so forth. Well, why? Well, it's awfully good that, I mean, you know, obviously before money existed, humans were around. And food, you can't imagine a baby going out in the wilderness and bringing food back to feed its parents. So what's going on here has to be built in, or we wouldn't have survived as a species. This is particularly true for the human, because we have the longest dependency between parent and child of any primate. A chimp is pretty well on its own by after a year or so, maybe two. Imagine a three-year-old child on its own. It would be destroyed quickly. A 12-year-old child, even so, very vulnerable to exploitation and destruction. Today, I think even 22-year-olds are very vulnerable to destruction. And according to certain psychologists, it's going to be the same even for 32-year-olds. They have to go back and live at home because they can't afford the rent. So it's built in, and this is very necessary and important. They now know that during pregnancy, the female brain changes. In fact, the brain areas involved in interpersonal responses both actually get larger during pregnancy. The areas for interpersonal and for emotionality and interpersonal bonding, and the areas for face recognition get larger during pregnancy. This is part of what is sometimes called the mommy brain. Male and female brains also appear to be wired differently in a way that supports the general complementarity interpretation. Women's brains, here's the study, they met a large population of adult women and adult men, magnetic resonance imagery of, you know, what's going on in the brain, and they recorded the brain patterns under a variety of situations and tasks. Women's brains were found to be more connected across the corpus callosum. That is, women are highly connected across left and right hemispheres. I've already implied that with some of my earlier comments. That means that the neural pattern is horizontal, the dominant one, okay? Men's brains tend to be connected front to back, often within one hemisphere, within the right hemisphere or within the left hemisphere. These connections support the interpretation that women are better at social skills, at remembering social events, and at multitasking. Men seem wired for perception and coordinated physical actions, and not surprisingly have a better sense of direction. Women, however, have a better memory for concrete place location. These differences may reflect skills needed in the traditional distinction between male hunters and female gatherers. Both activities are essential for good social survival, and the difference anticipates our treatment of complementarity in men and women. Women have better memories for what psychologists call episodic events. That is, events usually involving a person and their activities and interactions with each other. They remember what people say, how they interacted, what went on, you know, what was the conversation over breakfast, and things like that. Men tend to have a better memory for facts and abstract ideas, such as the names of the capital city of every U.S. state or the value of pi to five decimals. These are two, and by the way, they're located differently in the brain, these two kinds of memory. Women also have a richer autobiographical memory and more detailed memory of their interpersonal life. They're more accurate with respect to dates of life events. Again, we see evidence of women's superior people skills. As the work of Baron Cohen has shown, men are better at systematic, abstract, and logical tasks. In addition, men's brains are more modular. Modularity means that men's brains appear to organize types of mental processing in more specific or modular brain areas than do women. This, combined with a tendency to function much more in one hemisphere, suggests to me that men are also, this is my interpretation, more irritated and crabby at being interrupted. That is, they need to travel a longer internal neural distance to address the interruption, as well as they have more difficulty escaping from their focus in a particular path, in a particular task, based on their modularity. For women, crossing the corpus callosum is much easier, and being less module-based, they can more quickly move from one task to another, even if they stay in the same hemisphere. If you think about interpersonal life, family life, dealing with children, not being disturbed by an interruption is necessary because you're always being interrupted. That's what people do with each other. They always interrupt each other. When men go hunting, you are not allowed to talk to each other. That would interrupt the focus on looking for the animal you're hunting. If you talk too much, you don't get invited back to the hunt. They don't want to talk, and you don't talk about emotions or feelings. You talk about, you know, where the deer or the elk are and how to get them and what's going on and what rifle at what distance and all of that. But men, when they get interrupted, I think become crabbier because of the internal jolt that they have to go through to get to the other task and so forth. That's my theory of crabbiness for men. You know, it's just, there are probably other reasons men are crabbier. But that's a good one, right? Okay, but now this introduces another important distinctively female characteristic, namely greater emotionality. Again, this is hardly a new idea per se, but the recent evidence from neuroscience gives it a much firmer basis. The greater emotionality is there from the start, with differences favoring emotionality in girls, but it is greatly increased during puberty and remains present as affected by a woman's monthly cycle. And as noted, it also tends to increase during pregnancy. A variety of different behaviors have been found to vary with a woman's monthly cycle and other varying hormones. Some interesting examples are ovulation led single women to become more liberal politically and less religious, while for women in a committed relationship, ovulation led them to become more conservative politically and more religious. A woman's cycle is related to the color of the clothing that she wears. Women tend to wear red during their during ovulation, when they're sexually available for pregnancy. They did that study. Okay. A woman's cycle is related to their perception of the masculinity of men's faces. All right, so there are lots of things that are related to the woman's cycle and affecting her attitude and emotions and openness to certain kinds of issues and stimulus environments, right? Now, some might argue that although women are more expressive of emotion, men are just as emotional but don't express it. There may be some truth in this, but there's also neurological evidence that men are probably, on average, less emotional than women. With respect to interpersonal emotions, we know that autism, more common in men, reduces the ability to empathize and understand that other people have emotions. Also, psychopaths, also more commonly male, appear to have little capacity to empathize with others. In addition, as I mentioned, the female brain tends to rest in the limbic system, which contains major emotional structures, while the male brain tends to rest in the medulla oblongata, which is less associated with emotion, brainstem reptile. Okay. A particularly important hormone, well, we have to move ahead. I have 10 minutes? Five? Five. He gave me five. He really signaled less. I have a lot of other material I could cover, but I won't. I guess the basic principle is this. If you're going to accept that there are significant differences, this means that men and women will be both better at some things and not so good at others. And at present, the feminists want women to be good at everything that's important. And not, you know, that they won't allow any male superiority on any dimensions. This is a kind of female imperialism. That is, they want to be good on all dimensions that are of any significance and not less good or worse on any dimension that's positive that men might be more superior on. So what we're looking at here is a balance between the two. And so here's where women are better, here's where men are better, on average again, and these two kinds of abilities make for a complementary and synergistic response. One of the things that's interesting to me, I just mentioned this in passing, as you know, men are more likely to be autistic, and a little bit of autism seems to be a good thing if you're going to be a scientist. Too much autism, no, but a little bit seems to be quite helpful. And I would like to propose that the concept of modern science, which began, let's say, with Bacon and Descartes, is a kind of autistic worldview. And the main reason is that they rejected intention and purpose, or telos, as being a property of the world. And therefore, they got rid of anything that had the quality of a mind as present. But it's an assumption that was made for modern science. And if we come back to the issue of introducing telos or purpose or intention in some sense into the understanding of the world, we have broken from that implicit autistic set of assumptions underlying modern science. And we've gone back, of course, to Aristotle and a few other things, but we've made the world less hyper-masculine by the assumptions that you're operating on. Because the autistic person has trouble understanding that other people even have intentions. That's why autistic individuals tend to be more atheistic. A personal God is almost impossible for them to imagine. So, I only have 3 minutes now. And I will just conclude then by saying it's time for us to move ahead on understanding men and women. And we now have evidence that there are significant differences. But remember, equal dignity, significant difference, synergy when they work together positively, and creating of intergenerational family structures. That's what it's about. Now, I don't want to be overly optimistic about how complementary things are synergistic. We already know from some of our earlier talks yesterday that sometimes men and women's differences don't lead to complementary cooperation and synergy. They can lead to conflict, fighting, and so forth. But the whole notion that we were made originally by God for the synergistic aspect, for the positive interaction of these two, and the fact that even in terms of evolutionary theory, these two types of functions enabled healthy survival of the species, means that on average, the positive does seem to have dominated, the positive interaction of these differences. But right now, we're in a kind of world where there's an awful lot of non-synergistic interaction, a lot of competition, a lot of anger, a lot of criticism, a lot of bitterness, and so on. And so it's time to move past that with these other two models, which are, I think, obsolete and not truthful. No difference, except maybe a little bit of the plumbing is different between men and women. But that doesn't add up to the truth. And the other one, that one is dominating the other, that we reject also. It's this complementarity that is the name of the future understanding, I believe, for men and women in our society. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Witz. We have time for one, possibly two questions. You don't need to write them down. If you wish to raise a hand if you have a question, We have a couple of moments.
As Graham Hutton, director of the ITI. Fascinating talk. Thank you so much for that. Could I ask one very precise question, but probably difficult to give a simple answer to? I appreciate that all of the things you've described are averages, as you said. But could you give a rough estimate of whether of what the sort of degree of differentiation is? So, for example, on all of the things you. Where you said men are more X than Y, women are more A than B. Yeah. Is that a difference of sort of 52-48, or are we talking 80-20? I mean, is it a huge measurable difference, or are we talking about quite small differences?
No, these are significant differences that are reliably found, so I don't know how they'll vary with what property you're talking about. But they show up most normally in the extremes. All you have to do is have two distributions with half a standard deviation of separation, and the proportion of people in that are way out on the extreme will be almost always from the one distribution that's only a half a standard deviation apart. So the extremes show up there. The extreme male kind of brain, according to Baron Cohen, is the autistic brain, four to one autistic children are boys versus girls, and it's an extreme male kind of thinking. I think, on the other hand, you have this is a new theory, so you can take it cum grano. That there are some women who have extreme tendencies to see relationships everywhere. They have 100 cats. Each one has a nice relationship with her. You know, they have 100 cats. They see relationships everywhere. They may even have relationships with trees and flowers and plants and, you know, that type of thing. They see relationships in spirituality, the New Age things where they have all sorts of earlier forms of life and then earlier identities and people they're channeling and all of this. They do too much relationship. But so these are moderately different on the average, extremely different on the extremes, which is often what society will use most or focus on. But I would also point out that something, let me think about it this way. Let's think a person is made up of 20 dimensions. I mean, you know, that's not valid, but we'll think about it. 20 dimensions, and each one is a stick. And what we'll do is have it, pink or pale blue, depending upon whether it's tendency to be male or female. And so you get a group of 20 sticks for each woman and a group of 20 sticks for each man. Now, on average, those sticks won't all be of one color for either of them. But in general, you'll see, those are the blue sticks, and that's the man, and these are the pink sticks, and that's the girl, right? So you notice on average, but there'll be reversals in there. Some women might be the ones who take charge of all the economic activity in the family. And that might be normally done by the man, but still sometimes it's done by the woman. And so, so in general, when you look at somebody like a bundle of sticks, you know they're a man or a woman. Now, the gender ideology people, they think you can pick and put the sticks any way you want. And so it goes from, you know, I think, therefore I am. Therefore I am a man today. Oh, I think, therefore I am. I will be a woman tomorrow. And as I saw in a recent transgender portrayal of a real transgender person on the internet, I will be a dragon tomorrow. I don't know if you saw that, about somebody who had operated, cut his ears off and everything, turning it and nose, everything, become a dragon. Now he says he will be an it. All right, that is I am who I will choose to be. I am who I am. And that is, of course, a genuine parody of I am God now. That's a parody of the great temptation to be as God. And that's where cogito ergo sum, I think, I want, I, you know, the will of Nietzsche. This is all about I will be what I want to be. And I will create myself. It's another way of saying you are not created by God. You are created by yourself. And this is what the gender ideology is basically about. Because eventually it means I'm not even going to be a human. I'm going to become a dragon. Sorry, okay.